Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. British historian Neil Ferguson says that September 11th was the historical equivalent of an unpredictable storm. It was a great tragedy, but did not change underlying historical trends. In fact, he says, it all fit the climate. The spread of terrorism, an impending energy crisis, a new American imperialism, and the mounting fragmentation of nations would all have happened anyway, with or without the September attacks. This hour, Neil Ferguson on life in the 9/11 storm system. First, the FBI extends its terrorist threat warning until after the Olympic Games are over in Salt Lake City. David Johnston is Justice Department correspondent for the New York Times. I asked him how the new threat advisory differs from the ones that came before it.
This one, by the accounts of people at the FBI and at the Homeland Security Office, seems to be intended to basically keep law enforcement authorities on their toes through the Winter Olympics. It appears not to result from any new specific threats against targets in the United States.
So it's simply based on the notion that the Olympics would be an attractive target for terror activity.
I think that has been a concern for a long time, I mean since September 11, that this was going to be, you know, a very large international event with a huge global audience and was therefore a potential target. In contrast to the other threat alerts that we've seen, this one did not come with a press release, so to speak. There was no public announcement of the threat.
Who did the announcement go to, David?
It went from, sort of legalistically, it went from the FBI to the 18,000 or so state and local police agencies mm-hmm. around the country.
A lot of those are very far from Salt Lake City, but yet they were alerted anyway?
Yes, because of the nature of the way they do these things. Clearly, the authorities in Utah and around Salt Lake have been, you know, on a state of alert for, you know, many months at this point. They really, I think, didn't really need another warning. I think this is just intended for authorities elsewhere to be cautious.
With the size of the target and with the historic memory of 1972 and terrorism in Munich, the threat must feel really disconcerting to people right now.
Well, I think it does. There's also the 1996 Summer Olympics. There was a bombing in Atlanta.
Right.
And that is, you know, fresh in the minds of the FBI. That was clearly, you know, believed to be domestic terrorism. But there is a track record here, 72, 96, and now with 9/11. I mean, I think that, you know, in the view of authorities, they have a reason to be concerned. There's an old adage in intelligence and in the world of threat assessment mm-hmm. about credibility and specificity. As a warning is more specific, it's usually regarded as less credible. Mm-hmm. And in this case, these warnings are, you know, come in the form of electronic intercepts. There's a bit of human intelligence here, but these are vague, and in some way, those are deemed to be more credible, even though they're very elusive and it's very difficult.
So I want to be sure I understand, David. Are you saying that this is not just about concern that the Olympics would be a good target, but that there is some general intelligence pointing to a potential terrorist plan?
Correct. This is nothing new, they will tell you. This is the kind of information that has been coming in really since 9/11, that there is a generalized threat level out there that is a cause for concern.
Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge is scheduled to inspect the site of the Olympics in Salt Lake City, Utah, next week. What preparations on the security front is he likely to learn about there?
Well, I think that there's clearly an enormous physical security apparatus and a series of sort of physical checkpoints and all the rest, and also a screening of basically anybody who's going to get inside the games and inside the sites. And I think the spectators will also experience unusually heavy level of screening as they seek to sort of get into to the various venues where events are going to be held.
Finally, David, this announcement was not made public. Why not?
Well, it's funny. It's not so much that it wasn't made public. It was not accompanied by a news conference in which a senior official stood up and declared there to be a threat.
Mm-hmm.
It was not sent to these police authorities in secret. There simply was not the same kind of public announcement. And in part, there had been criticism in the past, both outside the government, in Congress, and by some counterterrorism people, that these vague threat alerts were very difficult for people to deal with. It was very hard for people to know how to respond to these when they were so vague, and that there was a risk that the government was simply alarming people without really giving them any information that was of use to them.
David Johnston is Justice Department correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Washington. It's not Pearl Harbor or the beginning of World War III, says Oxford Don Neil Ferguson. America will remember September 11th as a great tragedy, but history, he says, will see it as just one storm in a vast storm system that America has just begun to understand. How do you think 9/11 will be seen 10, 20 years from now? And are you prepared to see it as a taste of the life to come? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Neil Ferguson joins us now from New York. He's a professor of political and financial history at the University of Oxford and author of The Cash Nexus, Money and Power in the Modern World, 1700 to 2000. Good evening and welcome, Neil Ferguson.
Good evening, Tom.
And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Neil Ferguson, it's entirely common now to say in the United States that September 11th was a historic turning point. You say it wasn't. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't mean to diminish in any way the scale of the tragedy. That obviously would be quite unreasonable. And I've only just this very moment come uptown from Ground Zero.
Mm.
And it's impossible not to be moved by the scale of the devastation, even now when there's been the most remarkable salvage operation going on there.
So did it change your mind, Neil Ferguson?
No, it didn't. Mm-hmm. It didn't in the sense that what I'm saying is not that this wasn't a tragic event, not that this didn't touch the consciousness of all Americans, indeed, I think, of most people around the world. Rather that in 10 years' time, when we look back and ask ourselves, did this really change the direction that history was moving in?
Mm-hmm.
I think when we ask that question, the answer will be not really, because the underlying trends, which I tried to identify in a piece I wrote for the New York Times magazine, mm-hmm. were already discernible. Put it this way, the Cash Nexus was published in early 2001,
mm-hmm.
and in that book I said something along these lines, it is very easy to imagine a major terrorist attack on an American city. So it was easy to imagine. It wasn't a difficult thing to predict. And equally, it's easy to see that there will continue to be profound instability arising from the fact that the bulk of the world's oil reserves are centered in the Middle East.
Neil Ferguson, so we credit you with some foresight there, but it wasn't just crystal ball gazing. You were, and not just the obvious vulnerability of the cities, but you were essentially saying there are trends here that are pushing us in a dark direction. What are those trends?
Well, the first trend is the spread of terrorism. The only surprising thing is how long it's taken terrorism to reach the American city. I've spent most of my life in the United Kingdom. British cities have been targets for terrorists for over 20 years now, and the possibility of a major terrorist incident in London has become a part of everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, nothing on the scale of September the 11th has ever happened in London since the Irish Republicans began their bombing campaign, but I think that largely reflects the Irish Republicans' incompetence and possibly the more limited nature of their campaign of violence. It doesn't really alter the fact that the possibility of major civilian casualties in British cities is a familiar one. It's been a familiar one in Spanish cities for years since ETA, the Basque separatists, mm-hmm. waged their campaign. And the point is very simple. It is easy for tiny minorities of violently disposed extremists to cause very substantial amounts of damage because the technology to blow up big buildings has been there. It's been there for years. And the only surprising thing really is that it took so long for an American city to be hit as hard as New York was this year.
And yet Americans have never seen the world that way. The fact that it might have been easy doesn't change the fact that it didn't happen for a long time. You say there are larger trends that are pushing everything in this direction. What are those big trends that you see driving us forward, that you see 9/11 as an illustration of?
Well, the spread of terrorism as a form of political action is one of four trends I've tried to identify, which I think have been underway for some time and which September 11th threw into bold relief. The second, I think, is the fundamental problem of dependency on oil. This problem has been in many ways disguised by the relatively cheap oil price in the last decade or so, but it is latent and it's potentially almost as serious as the problems of the early 70s and the early 1980s. And we can't ignore the fact that as long as Saudi Arabia is a major center for the world's oil reserves and as long as the United States guzzles petroleum the way the U.S. economy guzzles petroleum, we are going to have fundamental problems arising from this dependency on oil in the foreseeable future.
But Neil Ferguson, what's the problem there? We're driving big SUVs. The price of oil is low. It doesn't feel like a problem at the moment.
Well, of course, it doesn't feel like a problem right now. The question we're asking is, how will it look in 10 years' time?
And what do you see there?
In 20 years' time. And I think it's very clear that the price of oil will be higher in 10 years' time, unless there are radical changes in patterns of consumption in the United States. And I don't think one can really explain this away. I've yet to hear, although people say to me, I wrote this piece a few weeks back, and people have said to me, gosh, you're very pessimistic. A number of people have said this to me since I've been in New York, as if it was really rather subversive of me not to be upbeat. But I've yet to hear anybody actually offer substantial evidence to the contrary, that the fundamental dependence of the Western economies remains on reserves in the Middle East. And ultimately, we can't rule out the fact that the fundamental goal of the organization Al-Qaeda is not really to achieve radical changes in the situation of Israel. It has very little to do with the future of Afghanistan. It has everything to do with the future of Saudi Arabia. And in that sense, the big underlying trend is very clear. And it's been there for decades. It's been there for, indeed, most of the second half of the 20th century. The fundamental dependence of Western capitalism on oil, which is heavily concentrated in Arabia, is a big problem.
But the crunch time
really brought it back to the surface.
But the crunch time, the problem with that always seems to be decades away. You're saying it's no longer decades away?
Well, we can actually pinpoint quite clearly the point at which the reliance on Middle Eastern reserves is going to increase. I mean, there's been a period when OPEC has been relatively weak. There have been successful exploitation of reserves in other parts of the world, but those are going to run out. They really aren't very substantial. And we're talking about 10 years or 15 years at most.
And will there be consequences beyond higher prices?
Well, it's very hard to make that kind of call because, of course, the question really becomes at what rate does the U.S. economy grow? At what rate does it require to consume gasoline? And could there be any change in patterns of behavior? Could the SUV become redundant? One of my predictions was that the SUV will be very quickly rendered redundant if there are significant increases in the price of gasoline.
Neil Ferguson, we know you're also projecting a more formal American imperialism and a more fragmented world. We're going to talk about those after a break, but I want to bring Jack Beatty in here for a moment. Jack, Neil Ferguson has a view of the world that certainly doesn't see 9/11 as a one-time event.
No, I think he uses the image of a cloud, that history isn't like billiard balls, one hitting the other, September 11th hitting something and then changing, but rather like cloud formations, and this fits into these pre-existing movements. And, you know, the question about energy, those are the trends. But, of course, America could reverse that by really getting serious about conservation, by forcing Americans to pay the real cost of energy, that is to say the foreign policy and military policy that is in the cost of gasoline and it's hidden from us. And, of course, that would force us all to conserve. It would really discourage the SUV. It would make the planet, the biosphere, a lot safer. There's nothing inexorable about this dependence on Mideast oil. This is a reversible trend.
Jack, Neil Ferguson, hang on. We're going to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Neil Ferguson's hard vision of the future. It looks scary out there. 9/11, he says, is just an illustration of some big trend lines we're on. What do you think? Can American ingenuity, can anyone's ingenuity change the hard future? Neil Ferguson foretells, can we change a future of global terror, inequity, and fragmentation? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Neil Ferguson, a professor of political and financial history at the University of Oxford and author of The Cash Nexus, Money and Power in the Modern World, and with our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. The subject is the future and 9/11 as perhaps an illustration of tough things to come. Neil Ferguson describes a pretty rugged future. Are you ready for anti-aircraft guns on your city's skyline? Does it have to be this way? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Neil Ferguson, you say that the United States has been a casual or informal imperialist since the end of World War II, and that it will now be drawn into a more formal imperial role. What do you mean by that?
Well, essentially, since the Second World War, I guess you could say a decision was taken by American voters and politicians not to take on Britain's role as world policeman directly, not, in other words, to try and rule directly over large parts of the world's population, but rather to do it indirectly, to rely on American business, multinational companies, American investment, but to leave the politics in the hands of local indigenous rulers. This was really the pattern of the Cold War, in which the political process appeared to be one of decolonization as the old European empires were very quickly wound up, and it appeared as if independence movements were triumphing everywhere. In reality, most of these independence movements were backed either by Washington or Moscow, and that's what I mean by informal rule, where essentially you let the local guys appear to be ruling, but in practice you exercise considerable leverage, financial, commercial, and possibly also military leverage.
For better or worse, that sounds like a situation many Americans have probably grown fairly comfortable with, but you're saying that won't be enough now? What is it you're predicting and why?
Well, I think the problem is clear, that and it was something that the British themselves discovered. They experimented with informal empire in the 18th and early 19th centuries. And the trouble is that the local guys tend not to do what they're told. And often the regimes that you're propping up can turn out to be highly unstable. And I think one can see this very clearly in the Middle East and also in the Indian subcontinent. Countries like Saudi Arabia and in some measure also Pakistan are not really the easiest countries to shore up. These are not necessarily regimes which do what they're told, which conform to Western standards. And, of course, we can see that these are also regimes which have supported the Taliban regime. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, it's clear, given considerable financial support to the Islamic fundamentalist organization, which carried out the 11th September attack.
But so what are you really suggesting here? That we, when you say we have to become a more formal imperial power, what does that mean? We set up a satrapy in Arabia? That we actually send in some kind of clerks to run these countries? Is this a Kipling white man's burden thing? That sounds nauseatingly out of date. Suggesting?
You say it's out of date, but of course there are already colonies being run in the name of the United Nations in Kosovo, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in East Timor.
Colonies?
Well, they are de facto colonies, and in fact, I've heard European diplomats describe them as such. I think the important point about the American attitude towards imperialism is that as a country forged in a revolt against British imperialism, you are very squeamish indeed about formal imperialism. Mm-hmm. And I suppose burnt fingers in Vietnam don't really help matters. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't think American formal imperialism will be done in the name of the United States. It will be done in the name of the United Nations. I think that's already clearly happening in Afghanistan, where the usual UN peacekeeping force is being sent in the wake of the U.S. military operation. But
I don't think this is it. Kosovo and Afghanistan, you're saying this is it. This is the new, more
this
formal.
This is the future. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You basically dispose of rogue regimes, and then once the American military has done this, you send in notionally United Nations forces to govern these countries. Mm-hmm. It's not very pretty, but it's preferable to rogue states. And that's, I think, what will happen increasingly in the future.
And your final big trend is increasing fragmentation along, if I understand you correctly, ethnic lines?
Well, what I was trying to get at was that I think it's misleading to imagine the world on the verge of or in the grip of a clash of civilizations in the way that Samuel Huntington, recently lionized in the Atlantic Monthly, has predicted. This implies huge monolithic entities, Western civilization pitted against Islamic civilization with Confucian Chinese civilization mm-hmm. somewhere in the background.
Would seem to, yeah.
And, of course, this is very tempting because it simplifies the world and it's nice to have the world simplified, but the reality is very different. I mean, Islam is a highly fragmented, heterogeneous religion. It's absurd to group together people as diverse as, the Muslims of Indonesia with the extreme radical Wahhabist Muslims who are mm-hmm. clearly the rank and file of Al-Qaeda, any more than it's reasonable to talk about Western civilization as if something called Western civilization has been around as long as Islam.
Now, but you're not saying that the clash of civilization, that the opposite of it is peace, love, and global harmony.
No, the opposite of it is something which is really much more insidious, which is a kind of political fragmentation. Probably the most striking phenomenon of modern history, certainly since the Second World War, has been the increasing fissiparity of the world's political structures, the proliferation of new small states, which goes on all the time. The number of states has roughly doubled since the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. And this process shows very little sign of letting up.
What's the problem with that?
Well, the problem is that little states aren't terribly efficient, neither economically, nor are they particularly stable. One characteristic feature of the post-Cold War world has been an upsurge of civil wars, and usually these new states are forged by some kind of civil war. The classic phenomenon is the Balkanization phenomenon, and we've seen what happened in Yugoslavia as petty nationalities were able to reassert themselves in the wake of the disintegration of communism. And I think that's the kind of thing which is far more real than this clash of civilizations notion. We're really looking at a world of increasing fragmentation along ethnic and religious lines, not of enormous blocks of enormous cultures grappling with one another like Godzilla and King Kong. Rather, what we see is a fragmentation of existing political entities. And that makes for a much more unstable, volatile world, which is, I think, why the role of the United States and the United Nations as its front man seems to me to be such an important question.
Well, listeners, there you have it, Neil Ferguson's view of the world, and it's not a pretty picture. Global terrorism, a new energy crisis, American imperialism, and a new fractured multicultural polity. Does it have to be this way? Can we change this future? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Larry is on the line. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how you doing?
We're well, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to comment that it strikes me that a lot of what we face currently in this particular situation is that we are dealing with the world as a country and as a culture based on expediency rather than based on some of the principles that I think we founded the country upon. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, you look back after the Second World War, Ho Chi Minh came to this country basing his Declaration of Independence upon ours and asked for our help to keep his country independent from the French, and we turned him down, and he went to the Soviets mm-hmm. Because we wanted to back up our friends, the French. And then we currently have a situation in the Middle East where, take a step back, you know, we have a war on drugs, which is to say we have war against the drug producers and traders, but we don't want to deal with the fundamental issues at home that create the demand for it.
But Larry, are you ready to step back and pay the price of being the principled global guardian?
I think that, you know, there are principles, and part of those principles is that, you know, while you don't care for violence, you're willing to defend yourself. There's nothing mm-hmm. wrong with that. However, I think people forget that the principles upon which our country were founded are principles upon which a reasonable and defensible and moral mm-hmm. foreign policy can be built, and that, by the way, most countries and peoples who want to rule themselves would admire.
Larry, thank you for your call, and let's put it to Neil Ferguson. Will we work our way out of this through expediency or principled foreign policy? I have to say, Neil Ferguson, on this very show, we've heard the high moral road and the tough realist road both described as the only way to go. What's your view?
Well, in some ways, discussions of American foreign policy have been bedeviled by this dichotomy between idealism and realism. Hmm. I blame Henry Kissinger for this. It's really another of these silly oversimplifications.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly a problem that
There's nothing like an Oxford Don to get us set right here. Tell us.
Well, I should add that I'm also a visiting professor at the Stern Business School at New York University, so I get some New York realism dunned into me every time I sound like an Oxford Don.
We're just poking you in the ribs. We want to hear. What do you think?
Yeah,
what is the balance? What is the balance?
Well, Bostonians have been poking Brits in the ribs for a long time now.
Yeah, we're still ready.
I think that you're never going to be able to have an American foreign policy which is divorced from idealism. And in some ways, Larry's absolutely right. The U.S. has ready-made a foreign policy for the world, which is be like us, have independence, have democracy, pursue happiness. And I think that's the starting point that really all American foreign policy has. There's a wonderful exchange. Can I illustrate this point, which goes back
sure.
to just before the First World War, when the British Foreign Secretary was talking to the American ambassador about what was going to happen in Mexico, where there had just been yet another military coup d'etat. And the American ambassador replied that obviously there might be the need for some intervention in order to restore democracy. And the foreign secretary looked rather puzzled and said, you're going to go in there and what are you going to do? You're going to force them to have elections at gunpoint. And the American ambassador said, yes, that's right. And then we're going to go. And the foreign secretary said, and the next time there's a coup, you'll go in and force them to hold elections at gunpoint again. And the American ambassador said, absolutely right. And I think this is the kind of fundamental assumption that Americans tend to make. That,
but what's your judgment on that?
It's unfortunately, it's a short-termist approach. You go in, hold elections, and get out. And my point is, take the case of Haiti, for example. You really do have to stay in somewhere like that a little longer than it takes to hold elections if you're going to stabilize it successfully. And here's where the realism comes in. I think Americans are absolutely right to have their ideals. I share them. I'm a great believer in the idea of a liberal, independent democracy. I sometimes even feel twinges of sympathy with republicanism. The point, though, is that people will not leap towards the American way overnight, and certainly not at gunpoint. If you're really serious about converting the world to freedom, economic and political freedom, you may have to be prepared for 20, 30, 40 years of supervising unstable rogue states.
Oh.
Let me remind
it's
you.
It's breathtaking, Neil Ferguson.
Well, is it so breathtaking?
Well, it is to an American ear, at least to mine.
Well, let me tell you a story just before you shut me up, because I'm always very impressed at how skeptical Americans are about this, and you're skeptical even now after September 11th. But let me remind you, there were two rogue states, the worst rogue states in all history, Japan and Germany, which the United States successfully defeated, occupied, and converted to the American way. But it was only done in the case of both Germany and Japan with a 50-year military occupation. So don't tell me there are no precedents for this.
All right, we won't tell you that. Jack Beatty, how does this sound to you? We're going to become imperialists for 50 years and then great lords of democracy.
Up here in my distant perch in Vermont, I don't know. I there are failed states. The UN has programs that it tries to deal with them. But, you know, the idea that the UN is going to come and sort of stay indefinitely in these places, that's where I certainly see what Neil is talking about. It's a lot of these places need nation building. They need supervision. They need help.
And Japan and Germany did get all those.
But in doing that, you know, the UN itself represents this infinitely divided world, 180 nations, and it's very unlikely to me that the UN is going to supervise or become the front man for a new kind of imperialism. That's very different from where essentially, you know, you'll have the Raj or the UN Raj. It's a very different picture from the UN acting as a kind of midwife to failed states, helping them revive. It did that in Cambodia. The UN isn't, occupying Cambodia today. So I think the kind of thing Neil is talking about isn't necessarily a permanent formal empire of the UN or the U.S., but rather the necessity of dealing with these messes around the world when they get the UN's attention and dealing with them, but on a temporary basis. In other words, I don't think this preludes, you know, the UN being in Afghanistan now and British forces there and Turkish ones to come. I don't think that preludes a new imperialism. I think what that stands for is an effort to try to shore up these countries and see if they can make a go of it themselves.
We're looking for the right name for it. A lot of callers want to join us. Let's open the lines. Paula is on the line from Providence. Welcome, Paula. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I read Neil Ferguson's piece in the New York Times Magazine a few weeks ago, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
It was great, wasn't it?
Yes. I have a couple of questions. I'll ask them briefly. The official U.S. government line is that we are at war against the Taliban. And what,
well, against terrorism, at least. I guess Taliban comes under that purview.
Yes. But what he wrote in his article was something like, the United States is at war against Afghanistan for the purpose of removing the Taliban from power. Now, when it's said that way, which I think is absolutely a perfect description of what is happening, that underscores how similar to virtually all other declared and undeclared wars our country has ever fought, this one is, that it's a war against a nation state to unseat a group that's considered evil.
Well, the group's unseated. What's your question there, Paula?
Well, the question is, in light of that, why do you think that Bush has not asked Congress to declare war? How does he benefit by avoiding that? And then the second part is, not being an American yourself, do you think that the American population's almost total avoidance of questioning of this war and the continuation of it beyond the Taliban is accounted for by anything more than the magnitude of the events of September 11th? Politicians, of course, are afraid to disagree because they're afraid of not being reelected. But I wonder what's your take on why almost all of the rest of the population is so afraid to disagree, and why is any objection to this war being so intensively equated with being un-American and unpatriotic?
Thanks, Paula. We'll get the British view. Neil Ferguson?
Those are good questions, Paul, and thanks for those nice things you said about the article. The first point about war is an interesting one. A lot of people in Britain thought it was a great mistake of President Bush to use the word war almost immediately after September 11th. We studiously avoided using the word war in our conflict with Irish Republican terrorists, not least because we did not want to dignify terrorists with the status of prisoners of war and legitimate combatants. And there's a paradox here, where the paradox is that Bush, on the one hand, has called this a war against terrorism, a war against the Taliban, from right away, but at the same time has resisted formally treating it as a war by actually getting a sanction from Congress. And I think myself that if one is really serious about combating terrorism, it's important to recognize that actually the kind of military action that we've seen in Afghanistan, spectacular and doubtless gratifying though it's been, has very little to do with the defeat of terrorism. I mean, terrorist organizations, the network which really threatens us extends throughout Western Europe and indeed into the United States itself. The real threats come from, in terms of the financial support, from Saudi Arabia, not from Afghanistan, one of the most poor countries in the world. The question I think one has to ask is how far the war against the Taliban regime in Afghanistan has been a form of post-traumatic therapy for the American public rather than a legitimate strike against terrorism.
Neil Ferguson will have to come to the rest of that answer after the break. We're talking with Neil Ferguson, professor of political and financial history at the University of Oxford. The question is, what kind of world are we headed into? 1-800-423-8255. You can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Oxford Don Neil Ferguson about 9/11 and its meaning. He says it was not a historical turning point, but rather an illustration of large trends already well underway. Where will they take us? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Neil Ferguson, Paula had one more part to her question, and that was, What do you make of America's relative unanimity, nearly, in support of this war effort, or at least the reluctance of Americans to stand up right now and be critical of it? We know that the British papers and airwaves are full of criticism of the U.S. at many levels. You don't hear as much here. That must be striking to you.
Yes, and the criticism's even more marked, I think, in Western Europe, where there's a long tradition of sneering at everything the Americans do. The French especially excel at this. I guess I'm not wholly surprised to come here and find such unanimity. I think the magnitude of the shock inflicted on the American psyche by the 11th September has no real parallel in living memory. It exceeds, I think, even the shock of Pearl Harbor, because of the proximity to the American heartland, if you like, of the attack. So I'm not wholly surprised by this. I think it would be really rather a reckless American politician or pundit who stood up and denounced what's being done. I'm in the happy position as a visitor from planet Europe of being able to express criticism without compromising my future chances of becoming president, since they don't exist. And I think it's of course, a perfectly good idea to intervene against a rogue state like the Taliban Afghanistan and depose the Taliban. I think this is excellent. In the Cash Nexus, I argued that this is just the kind of thing the United States should do with its power. And more strength to your arm. Do it to more rogue states. Get rid of them all, is my view. However, let's not pretend that this necessarily deals with the problem posed by the Al-Qaeda organization and the many other terrorist organizations that exist around the world. They will only be combated by intelligence, security measures, policing, things which have none of the romance of sending the Marines into a far-flung country and playing havoc with your superior firepower. So I think one has to guard against, and I think Americans must be very careful of this now that the victory against the Taliban is total, guard against complacency. You must guard against the feeling that the war against terrorism has been won. The Taliban regime has been deposed. Hooray. That doesn't really constitute a defeat for the forces that carried out the attacks of 11 September. It will take a lot more very dull, very prosaic work to do that.
Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to offer a different perspective on whether or not the events of September 11th were, in fact, historical.
Okay.
I think that your guess is correct in that they are an extension of a trend, and you know, we shouldn't be surprised that terrorism has reached our shores. But if you look at it another way, and what I'm suggesting is this is the first time that there has been an act of war on a nation state by a non-nation state. And I think that it's not that meaningful to look at September 11th as mere terrorism, in quotation marks, but rather there was a well-executed attack on our political, financial, and military centers. Now, the political one fell short because it went down in the hills of Pennsylvania. But, I mean, that was something substantively different from any prior type of terrorism, I think.
How about that, Neil Ferguson? And Mike, thanks very much for your call. This may not look historic to you in the UK, but I think many Americans do think this will resound in the way that December 7th and Pearl Harbor did. And Mike points out some of the reasons why. What do you say?
Well, most terrorist organizations are, of course, non-state organizations. They only become state organizations if they win. The best parallel I can think of between any past organization and Al-Qaeda is actually with the Bolsheviks in their early days. It was very fashionable in the wake of September 11th to talk about Islamofascism. I noticed a lot of people like Christopher Hitchens, writers on the left, who wanted to get in behind the war effort, the war against terrorism, eagerly seizing the idea that they were fighting Islamofascism, because obviously if anything is fascist, it must be automatically right to fight it. But actually, it bears virtually no resemblance to fascism. I can't think of a single point of comparison. It's much more like Bolshevism, the early radical communist movement.
And why? How so?
And early 20th century Russia. Because these were exactly the tactics that Trotsky and the young Lenin advocated. Tactics of assassination, destruction, terrorism designed to subvert what was then the Tsarist regime in Russia. And their aim was world revolution. Their aim was very similar, actually, to the aims that Osama bin Laden Laden, Adam Breitz. That is, you use your radical political religion, which is really what Islamic fundamentalism is, to arouse the resentment of the notionally oppressed against the dominant forces of capitalism.
Neil Ferguson, our clock is almost up. Give us your 30-second prediction. Will the U.S. one way or another deal with these trends that you outline in a successful fashion?
Well, Jack made a very good point, that it can deal with them. And I think my kind of hunch is that it will, because the United States is the most flexible, most successful political entity in all human history. I worry that it may take longer, it may be more costly than need be. But I remain fundamentally confident that an economy on the scale of the American economy and a polity as flexible as the American economy and, above all, a culture as resilient as American culture will ultimately prevail. These are enormous trends.
At the 11th hour, a vote of confidence, and we appreciate it. Neil Ferguson is professor of political and financial history at the University of Oxford and author of The Cash Nexus, Money and Power in the Modern World, 1700 to 2000. Neil Ferguson, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
Jack Beatty, there you go. Pick up your imperial garb and head out into the world.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Kipling, lesser breeds without the law. We'll have to. But I'm also thinking of another poem, and this is one that Dale quotes in one of his books. This one is from Matthew Arnold, who talks about Britain in the 19th century, weary titan struggling under the too vast orb of its fate.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. We don't really want to follow that path. We've had a vision of a kind of self-perpetuating systems. We could just plant the seeds, and between democracy and markets, all the rest would work on itself. Why can't that be, Jack?
Yeah, well, I think that's what people are hoping on. The third trend of his, of course, we didn't get around to was globalization. And his take on that, of course, is that's just widening the gap between the rich and poor nations dramatically. So that's less a solution than a further problem.
And we wanted it to go on autopilot. It's never that simple. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Tonight, we finish our series of conversations with poet Robert Pinsky on poetry and conflict with two poems written in response to September 11th and the War on Terror. Robert Pinsky.
The first poem I'd like to read to you is by Frank Bidart. It's a poem that I know Frank has not been in a hurry to publish. He is, I think, a little leery of the idea of making a really quick response to a really large event. It's the poem that I think has made the most impression upon me of the many that I've heard people read and many that I've seen published since then. And it's perhaps surprising that the poem is not very nice about this. The poem is called Curse, and it is indeed a curse, maybe tempered a bit by the fact that at the end the poet muses perhaps regretfully, on the fact that he has composed a curse. It very boldly goes into the imagery of the World Trade Center buildings and into the feelings of the first impact of that calamity.
All right, we're braced. Frank Bidart's Curse.
Curse. May breath for a dead moment cease, as jerking your head upward, you hear as if in slow motion floor collapse evenly upon floor as 110 floors descend upon you. May what you have made descend upon you. May the listening ears of your victims, their eyes, their breath, enter you and eat like acid the bubble of rectitude that allowed you breath. May their breath now, in eternity, be your breath. Now, as you wished, you cannot for us not be. May this be your single profit. Of your rectitude, at last disenthralled, you seek the dead. Each time you enter them, they spit you out. The dead find you are not food. Out of the great secret of morals, the imagination to enter the skin of another, what I have made is a curse.
Wow. Anger so deep it comes out as a curse. May what you have made descend upon you. Is anger a common theme in poetry that results from times of war and attack, Robert Pinsky?
I think that the secret of morals, empathy, getting to the skin of another, does involve a classic moral principle that may apply to violence in particular, which is violence in the senses impossible if you feel it's being inflicted upon yourself. In this case, it's wishing moral vision upon people and feeling that the moral vision would be enough. The person who deludes himself, in the phrase I like in the poem, perhaps the best, is your bubble of rectitude. Mm. That if that bubble of rectitude bursts and is penetrated and you realize that you are not acting in rectitude.
Rectitude so costly, so false.
Yes, yeah. And in the vision of the poem, the curse is to see truly, to see completely, and to feel what you have inflicted, to understand what you have inflicted. And that seems to me an unusually clear and unhackneyed response.
Robert Pinsky, we want to go out tonight on a poem that you've written since September 11th. Tell us about it, and we'll conclude with your reading of it.
My poem is called Newspaper, and I think it was probably necessary for me to try to make any poem I had that involved these events reflect the way I really do experience them, which is largely through the New York Times and the Boston Globe. Newspaper. They manufacture newsprint with a grain, so you can tear straight down a vertical column. But if you try to tear it crosswise, it rips out of control in jagged scallops and slashes, a serrated chaos like the blocks of smoking ruin. Here, amid columns, is a man who handles search dogs. He says the dogs depend on rewards, but not like the dogs I know, not dog treats. The lab will balance one on his muzzle, trembling and gazing up at you till you say okay, then he whips it into the air and snaps it and bolts it whole. No. What the handler says is that his dogs are trained to find survivors. That's their reward. Finding somebody alive is what they want. And when they try and try and never get it, they get depressed, he says. These dogs are depressed. Yes, what an animal thing depression is. The craving for some redemption is like a thirst. It's in us as we open the morning paper. Fresh, fallible, plausible. It says the smoke was mostly not paper or flesh. First white, the drywall, then darker pulverized steel and granite and marble, and then long smoldering toxic plastic and fiber. In the old days, the printing plant and the paper, meaning the Globe or Herald or Journal or Times, were in one building, and the tremendous rolls of newsprint tumbled off the trucks each day. When I was small, one crushed a newsboy's legs. There was a fund for him. I remember his picture accepting a powered wheelchair on special crutches. His name would be in the files of the Daily Record. The one-way grain is like the irrevocable downward river of time set into channels. Words broadcast on the air don't seem as solid. Paper, the bread of Kronos, titanic time that eats its children, and the crosswise jumble that won't tear straight unless you cut it is like darkness innate in things. The weather, the boy who beams up at the camera or down at his stumps. The prisoner who speaks an unknown language so that his captors guess and call him the Chechen. The errant, granular pulp. In some old stories, the servant rises early and reads it first, then gets the iron and presses the paper flat and smooth to place by the master's breakfast. The skin of days.
Robert Pinsky, former U.S. Poet Laureate and the creator of the Favorite Poem Project, reading his poem, Newspaper. You can listen to our entire series, Poetry and Conflict, and read the poems featured in the series by visiting our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.